We're back with Neil Gabler here on The Paula Gordon Show, also known as The Walt Disney Show at the moment. When I mentioned to a friend that we were going to be doing a program with you today, she said, Neil Gabler, which reminded me how important what you are doing is, that you are known in and of yourself, quite apart from Walt Disney. And then as I listened to you say that you internalized Walt Disney, you are known for talking about the Disneyfication of America. And yes. Richard Schickel did a pretty good job helping us think about that as well.
From a different perspective.
Indeed. Having taken on that persona in the course of writing this biography, I find a great deal that is Disney very, very troubling in the experience of being an American, in the experience of America in the world, in this fantastical, in the delusional, in what you call the triumph of the American imagination in some ways. Having spent 7 years in that mindset, shall we say, are you comfortable with that? I mean, you already, when you look at entertainment, are suggesting we might have some questions to ask about this entertainment motif. Were those questions enhanced for you by thinking your way through Disney, who is the archetypal American?
Yes, they were. You know, my last book before the Disney book was called Life the Movie, How Entertainment Conquered Reality. And as I said earlier, I mean, it is a book in which I deal with what I regard as the major cultural transformation of the 20th century, which is the conversion of life itself into an entertainment medium.
And you do have an opinion about the quantity as well as quality.
Yes, I do. I mean, although that book is more diagnostic than prescriptive, as most of my work is, frankly. I mean, I'm not there to tell people how they ought to live their lives. What I'm there to do is to examine the American scene and to try and understand it.
Because like a fish in water, we don't really see it until somebody like you tells us what we're in the middle of.
Exactly. I mean, that's how I feel. We don't understand the forces that surround us on a daily basis and that change our lives. And in writing Life the Movie, I can't tell you how many letters I got from people who said, you know, I never realized that indeed my life was essentially a movie and that I was performing a role within my life and that I was looking for certain narrative plot points within my life, certain things to fulfill, and how much of my life was surrounded by the props, the car I drove, the house I lived in, the place I sent my children to school. All of those things were part of a larger narrative that I was creating for my life.
Whether
I wanted to or not, but I almost felt compelled to do so. And in that book, I do talk about the advantages of doing so and about the disadvantages of doing so. Now, this is sort of the same approach I think that many people have had to Walt Disney. And in Walt Disney, in my book on Walt Disney, you know, I try and be very even-handed. You know, I try not to condemn Walt Disney or to praise Walt Disney, but to lay out a kind of analysis of Walt Disney and the whole notion of Disneyfication. On the positive side, there are people who believe that Walt Disney showed us a way to control our lives. The Disneyfication, which is often used derogatorily as faux experience, that Disney nevertheless said, look at, I know what real experiences are, but sometimes we need a release from real experience, and faux experience is a way of doing that. And as I've argued in other contexts, for those who criticize Disneyland, for example, for not confronting reality, I've said, well, wait a minute now. I don't know that that's a charge that is fair against Walt Disney because, what do you want to do? Go into Disneyland and find Holocaust land, slavery land? If you want reality, believe me, there's plenty of it outside Disneyland. You don't have to pay the money to go inside Disneyland to find it. And Walt understood that. Walt understood that berm that surrounds Disneyland was a physical barrier and a metaphoric barrier between a fantasy world and a real world. On the other hand, if that becomes part of your mental equipment, the whole notion of Disneyfication, if you look at the world through that prism, where you believe that everything can be converted into a fantasy because our will is strong enough now. As Daniel Boorstin once said, we are the first generation, he wrote this in 1961, who can live within its own illusions. If you really believe that, there is a tremendous danger in that.
And we're seeing much of that manifest.
Of course. I mean, if you think that the world will simply respond to your will, you are a fool, ultimately.
Well, if you think the world's a Western.
Yes.
Which is essentially, the, you know, I mean, that's, it's not just Disney.
Right.
Hollywood.
But Disney symbolizes a certain kind, which is why he's become the target of so many cultural critics, because he symbolizes a certain habit of mind.
And yet you say, look again. There's another way of thinking about Disney as well.
Part of the reason, though, I think, is those same critics also object to the reactionary he became, the political reactionary. And I think that
they thought he became.
Right. Yes. That I think affected their critique of Disney and their attitude, and really in many ways our now perspective on Disney.
Well, several things affected that critique. One thing is that when Walt Disney came to prominence in the 1930s, he was accepted by intellectuals as an artistic naif. Oh, they love this young, and he was young. Remember, when he creates Mickey Mouse, he's 26 years old. He releases Snow White when he's 36 years old. So he's a very young man when he rises to prominence. But they love the idea of this uneducated, as we talked about earlier, young artistic naif without any pretensions.
It's folk art.
Exactly. That's what they thought of Walt Disney as, a folk artist.
At a high level.
At a very high level. But even if he wasn't at a high level, the fact was there was a certain condescension, Paula, in that view of Walt Disney. And what they recognized when he made Fantasia and Walt showed his hand is that he wasn't unpretentious. He had tremendous pretensions. Walt Disney saw himself as an artist. And Fantasia, in my estimation, is the beginning of the end of Walt's critical reputation. Now, as you point out, Bill, that critical reputation, or the decline of that critical reputation, gains enormous momentum after the war, when he testifies before HUAC as a friendly witness.
HUAC being the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Yes, which is investigating Hollywood in 1947. And Walt comes and testifies as a friendly witness to talk about communist influence within the industry. And then Walt Disney is fingered as a reactionary. And that, as I say, only accelerates the momentum of his critical decline. So when you put together the idea that Walt is degrading popular culture with the fact that he is a reactionary politically, or at least perceived to be so, this is a double whammy against Walt Disney. Now, in point of fact, as I point out in the book, Walt Disney was largely apolitical. He had no interest in politics except after the strike. And after the strike, he believes that the studio was struck because there were communist elements in the Screen Cartoonist Guild, the union that was seeking recognition. And Walt believed that those communists were targeting Walt Disney. They were going to bring down Walt Disney. And he is vehemently anti-communist after that. He voted for Franklin Roosevelt in 1936, but after 1941, he is a hidebound Republican who is fighting communism.
Well, and there were communists. In the union.
There were communists in the union, as I point out in the book. Walt Disney wasn't entirely wrong. He didn't react to it, in my estimation, in a very productive way, but he was right in his analysis.
But he was wrong in the part that he played in this country becoming fearful.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, Paula, because there is a recent reinterpretation of Walt Disney, which I find very persuasive and very interesting, and I cite it in the book by a University of Texas professor by the name of Douglas Brody. And the book is called From Walt to Woodstock. And here's Brody's argument. His argument is that Walt Disney, far from being a reactionary in his films, regardless of what he was in his own personal life, and he was a Republican and he did contribute to Barry Goldwater and all of that, in his films, Walt was actually a promoter of tolerance, anti-authoritarianism, hatred of money, hatred of hypocrisy. All the things that we regard as liberal values were pervaded by Walt Disney's movies. And as I point out in the book, if you take a film as pathetic as Pollyanna, what is Pollyanna, which is actually a pretty good movie, what is Pollyanna really about? Pollyanna, this little girl who, through her goodness, converts this community, shames the hypocrites in her community, shames the religious authorities in the community for being hypocrites. It is a liberal movie, from a very illiberal human being.
Well, and if you think about it, I don't, you're a little younger than we are, but Fantasia played a role at a certain time in the 60s that, I mean, I know a lot of people who would use the available chemicals and go, and go off to the theaters that had rediscovered Fantasia. Again, this goes to the, you know, it ain't simple. You know, the idea
right.
that there is a Walt Disney. And there's a double twist in that because in some ways that simplicity appears to be what Walt Disney did, which is to simplify the faux reality as to the, as opposed to the real.
And he fed that, Bill. I mean, let's face it. At a point when he is turned on by the intellectuals, Walt Disney himself, as a defense mechanism, becomes somewhat anti-intellectual. So now Walt Disney is in the position of defending himself against his critics by saying, yeah, I'm simple, and so what? What are you going to do about it?
This is Neil Gabler, who just did what Walt Disney does and took on the character. Will, I'll be back in just a moment. We trust you'll be with us for a few more minutes with Neil Gabler here on The Paula Gordon Show.